Good evening, everybody. Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Ellen, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Please stay in your seats to minimize distractions while our speaker is talking. Tonight's speaker, as soon as I asked about her, there was just tons of positivity of the type of person that she is. Sounds like she is a big book enthusiast and have really delivered a lot of people in the AA program. And so with that, I give you Meredith. My name is Meredith. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Lisa for asking me to be here. I want to thank Tim for his encouraging words and all the friends that came out to hear me for I don't know how many, the umpteenth time. You know, I've got to give you a couple disclaimers. I am fully convicted about the efficacy of the 12 steps and the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I might sound like my way is the only way. It is not, but it definitely worked for me, and it continues to work for me. So I may sound like I'm an authority. I'm not. It's just my opinion. I'm just another drunk that, through desperation, found my way here to you. And I'm grateful for that and always will be. My sobriety date is May 30th, 1998. My home group is called It's in the Book. We meet at 8111 on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. and Sunday nights at 7 p.m. It was a study started by my first sponsor and I, and it has grown, as it says in the book, we've grown in numbers and power. I get a great deal of joy out of presenting the big book. For some reason, it's my gift, as my friends would tell me, but it keeps me really centered, and it speaks the truth to me. So anyway, that said, I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. As a kid, I was in a family of six. I was the oldest daughter. I was very outgoing and bubbly and sometimes a little uncontrolled. Some of my report cards, you know, told my parents, I'm going to get her to settle down a little bit sometimes. But they most of the time enjoyed my bubbly nature. I also, though, was prone to insecurity and not feeling like I fit and wondered what people thought of me and never felt like I was. I remember in fourth grade when Matthew Hill said I was part of the out crowd. I was devastated. And I was always kind of on the inside, didn't feel quite right. I was always thinking, why couldn't we have grown up in that neighborhood? You know, why couldn't we have more money like Debbie Levere's parents so I could have horseback riding lessons, even though I'm scared to death of horses, you know, but I still wanted the option, you know. And I also liked behaving well. I liked the rewards of behaving well. I was a dutiful daughter. I was raised in a home where we believed in God. And I was told that God created each one of us and put a little bit of Him in each one of us, and that connects us. And I thought, cool, I can go with that. And I went with my mother a lot to church. My dad didn't go a lot. And I saw that my mother got a lot of comfort from it. I liked the ritual of it. And it's not lost on me that the word spiritual has the word ritual right in the middle of it. You know, so there was a lot about that that brought me a great deal of comfort. And my mother was raised to believe in God first and her husband second. And then when my father walked out in 1970 and left her with six children in a town she had not grown up in with a bunch of people that didn't like us because we were not local, something happened to me. Something broke, you know. My mother was, you know, broken by God and her husband. And something snapped and I decided I'm not going to count on anybody ever. Now, I don't know if I consciously knew that, but something happened. Because I wanted to believe in God, but as life happened, I became less sure. Okay? My first experience with alcohol was 10 years old. why wait? It was Thanksgiving, and Grandma said, oh, let the kids have a little champagne, what could it hurt? And we had these adorable little glasses, and I drank mine, and my brother Matthew didn't like his, and I drank his, my sister Jackie didn't like hers, and my brother Jeffrey. I had about 4 ounces of champagne, and I was lit, and I loved it. I felt all warm inside and giggly, and I remember doing somersaults and playing the piano for my Aunt Ginger, and I hate playing the piano. So something happened, you know, and I remember I needed a nap. I took a nap, and then woke up with a terrible, terrible headache. And I went back to school on Monday, and I said, Thanksgiving was great. We got to drink champagne, and we drink champagne at Christmas, too. So, you know, I'm taught by this book that alcoholism is a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession. And before I even realized that, that obsession had already rooted itself in the back of my mind. Because instead of caring about that snuggle bun doll that I kept obsessing about for Christmas, now it's like, champagne, champagne, champagne. And I remember the following Thanksgiving, I was 11, and I was thinking to myself, I wonder if anybody would think it was odd if I asked for a bigger glass. And I was 11. Right? Now, my parents' house looked like Mad Men. My father was an executive in New York City. This was before he split. And a big fancy cocktail parties, and all the kids had to be in the children's area, which was really boring. And downstairs, there was cigarette smoke and laughter and clinks of glasses. And I would go down there after the party and, you know, eat those cherries, drink the bottom of those drinks, and that was fabulous. And I remember going to visit Grandma, and she had a real twinkly eye. And she also smelled kind of good. And it was, I realized that had something to do with that multifaceted bottle on a refrigerator. That was Seagram's gin. So Grandma had a thing about her, you know, and I was always enamored with this. You know, it always kind of caught my eye. So fast forward, Dad leaves. He moves us to the Adirondacks where we don't know anybody. We don't have one of the three most popular last names in this little village, so we're definitely not cool. And so we're kind of outsiders. And we kind of had to fend for ourselves. And I remember, get this, 7th grade through 12th grade, all on one floor. And fast little Meredith is mingling with the juniors and seniors, you know. And so there's parties, you know, a New Year's party someone's having at their house, and what do you want to drink? And I said, what tastes like champagne? Now, 4 years later, it's in there, right? So anyway, so thus began my career of drinking, and it looked like drinking on the weekends, making a fool of myself, developing a very bad reputation, and then trying to get over myself all week long by getting high average, being in student council, being a cheerleader, you know, all that stuff, to sort of overcome this nightmare that I was on the weekends, which was a nickname I earned when I was a bartender. Nightmare. You know, not everybody can say that. So my drinking took on serious proportions from the very beginning. And I remember my mom didn't really know how to deal with it, and she kind of turned her, you know, she kind of averted her glance and was just trying to keep herself together. She became alcoholic after my father left, and I remember thinking, I'm never going to be like that. I'm not going to smell like that. I'm not going to lie like that. I'm not going to not show up like that. No, I'm going to be way worse. Yeah. So I graduated, you know, I like to tell people how well accomplished I was. I was valedictorian in my class, and that's only because there were only 23 people in it, and the smartest guy graduated a year early. So I got that by default, okay? And coupled with this, you know, this striving to be, you know, achieve, was me just trying to overcome my own self-sabotage. And what, so it looked like, you know, people would say, well, she came from a broken home, and she just means, you know, her father left, and that's how they act out and all that. And, you know, I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. And my fear is no one's ever going to love me, you know, my, who's going to take care of me? I'm on my own. I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. But what it turns out, what it looks like is, that woman has gone wild. And she's not very Miss Rankerball. And I knew that, but I would try to push that deep inside me, like it says in the fifth step. We hope these memories don't see the light of day. And I didn't realize the toll that was taking on my innermost self year after year after year. I kept trying to overcome my, I ended up, what happened? So I go to high school, I go to college. I go to college to be a nurse because my mom was a nurse and I didn't know what to do. But I realized that's a calling and it's not like a job. And I realized I'd be better off just playing one on TV. So I changed my major to theater and dramatics and literature. Now, that's great if you want to play. You know, I did a lot of character acting, and it was a lot of fun. But then, oh, my God, I graduated. I'm like, holy cow, what am I going to do with this self-initiated major? I should have known anything based in self was doomed to fail, which you guys taught me also. But meanwhile, I went home back to that little town and got a job on the third shift flipping burgers at a truck stop where the truckers called me their little tomato. And my mom was disappointed in the way my life had gone. And so I applied for a job with the Olympic Committee. I'm not going to, well, 1980, that's how old I am. So I got a job working for the 1980 Winter Olympics. So I arrived, and I get the expense account, the truck, and I'm way cool, but only lasts 9 months. So at the end of that, I crash and burn again. And I end up staying in the town where I was in the Olympic Committee and became a cocktail waitress. But don't worry, I had aspirations. I was going to be the head bartender. You know, because bartenders and drug dealers were my heroes. They were. And I spent 10 years in that loop of drinking and drugging and drinking and drugging and doing shameful things and wishing I could overcome them and never could. So I ran to Georgia, stayed with my sister. People of faith have a logical idea of what life is all about. And that was my sister and her husband. And I stayed in their house and got a job as a waitress. 33 years old, really, really making strides here. And but I was going to, my goal was to get a job, a bartending job, and then become a psychiatrist or a psychologist, because I was always listening to people's problems at the bar. Why not get paid for it? But then what happened was I kept succeeding in the restaurant business, because that's a good place for alcoholics to work. And you just have to be a little bit smarter and it'll show up a little bit more on time, and you got it. You know, and so I kept getting promoted, and I had big responsibility, but I would be in this cycle. I'd work the 12-hour shift, I'd go to the bar, I'd drink, and I'd time myself, okay, I'm only going to drink two, then I'm going to drink until midnight, then I'm going to drink until one, then I'm going to drink until two. The condition of my mind, the insanity repeated day after day, you know, that's what the insanity is, that thought that we buy into every single day and do it again and again, thinking it's going to be different. You know, and I wanted to not live that way. I would go to work every day hungover and stinky, you know, and the best offense is best defense is an offense, so I'm going to be very offensive, so you guys stay away from me. You know, I ruled by fear and intimidation, not telling them I was more afraid than anybody. You know, and that went on for a long time. And then, jeez, I mean, I had some moments of clarity, and I did have some moments of incomprehensible demoralization. You know what that means? It means to be robbed of spirit, courage, and self-discipline. And I hit that place more than once. And I would bounce back. You know, after a couple of days, I'd bounce back. Because I had a good forgetter. And I would try again. You know, like it says on somewhere on page 23 or something, there's no solution. Everybody hopefully awaits the day when they'll rouse themselves from their lethargy and assert their will. But the tragic day may never come. And everybody, including me, was kind of hoping, but at the same time, I knew I'm toast. I mean, as many times as I ended up there, I knew that this was going to be, I really thought it was going to go on endlessly like that. I didn't know it was going to be progressive and maybe get a lot worse. Fear sobered me one time for 3 days. I almost hit another car. Well, if a car had been there, I would have hit it. Driving drunk, in the wrong lane. Thought, oh my God, I could have killed somebody. Shaking like a leaf. And when I got back to my house, I thought, that's it. I'm not drinking. And that lasted exactly 3 days. So my obsession was really strong and kept driving me back. And there's a line in the big book that says, this is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. It's the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. And I'd wish to begin leaving it alone when I was in college, when the townies had my number. Okay? You know, I went to a women's college to kind of stay away from the boys, because boys and drinking seemed to not be a good mix for me. But there's townies and football. You know, so that didn't work. You know, it's like the Eskimo who thinks he's going to escape drinking by going to Greenland, right? So I always ended up, David Bowie has a song, and there's a lyric that says, I'm always crashing in the same car. And actually, that story was about him. He kept crashing into his drug dealer's car because he wouldn't sell him any more drugs. David Bowie, in Germany, right? So it happens to the best of us. I don't know, really, the beginning of the end for me was, it kind of came in three parts. So I am the director of recruiting for my company. My job is to resource talent, assess the talent and train the talent to be managers in our growing company. Because as a general manager, the owner of the company would say, send that guy to Meredith, she'll make him or break him as a manager. So I was known for, that's my reputation. But I was known for finding out sooner rather than later, not wasting all my money on people that wanted to train and move up. So this delusional alcoholic is in Myrtle Beach, where we have several restaurants, and I get very drunk, and I don't know that everybody in the bar is someone that works for my company, because I don't know who all those people are. And I end up telling off a GM, and I end up, I think, dancing with a waiter on the bar, and a couple other things, and I have a very shadowy recollection. So the COO, who was someone I really admired, he had great integrity, and called me about a week later, and now I'm finally shaking off the pain and the suffering of a week or a month ago, right? I'm just getting loose of it. And he calls and says, it's Sunday morning. And he calls and says, hey, you available? And I said, sure. He said, we got to talk about something. I said, okay. He said, I'm in Atlanta, meet me at Joey D's. I'm like, he lives in Myrtle Beach, it's Sunday. And I felt like I was going to wet my pants. So I said, okay, I'll meet you there. And as he walked in the door, I walked up to greet him, and he said, we have some very serious things to talk about. And he revealed to me some of these things from my last adventure. And he said, we got to clean this up. You have to always be professional. And I remember telling him, I'll make it right, and you'll never have to talk to me about this again. And I knew when I said it, I didn't know if I could keep that promise. I'd gotten to the point where I couldn't trust myself anymore. You know, the book talks about how we lose our self-confidence and reliance upon things human, and I was the last human I could rely on. And I didn't trust where I was going to go, who I was going to end up with, and what I was going to do. But I assured him it would never happen again. And so it's, dawning on me, I just don't know drinking thing. And then the next thing that happened was I became diagnosed with diabetes, which, first of all, I was losing a lot of weight. And my sister said, and I was really thirsty, my sister said, sounds like you have diabetes. And she goes, you got to go to the doctor. I said, can I wait until I hit my goal first and then go? Yeah. But I remember thinking that when you have diabetes, you can lose your eyesight and you can lose a limb. So I had a moment of vanity. Because I thought, I don't need to be with big bulgy glasses and a prosthetic in that bar that I go to and have people dance with me. They're not going to dance with someone with a wooden leg. And that's how attractive I was. And as I said, no, I mean, I saw this. I fast forward. I thought, I wouldn't put it past me to take that thing up and throw it out. You know what I mean? I was that kind of a drunk. I mean, that nightmare name was earned, I came by it honestly. I worked for a woman in Lake Placid who owned a bar. She's sober today, too. I went and saw her this past summer, stayed at her house for a couple nights. When she drank, they called her Cujo. And every now and then, the two of us would go on a tear, and those bartenders would call the next bar around the lake and say, lock the doors. Nightmare and Cujo are out. Unbelievable. I can laugh at it now, but what a terrible way for a woman to be viewed, And I remember when I was a daughter, I wanted to be the good daughter, and I wanted to make my parents proud, and I wanted to be respected. I remember I wanted to be respected by men like Donna Kelly. She was in my class. Her father was a sergeant, state trooper. And if a guy asked her out, they'd have to go to her front door and knock on the door and meet Trooper Kelly. And they'd have to pass that test. If you want to date me, you just got to call me up and say, hey, look, I'm going to be driving by the house in a double clutch in the hollow, turn around to the graveyard. When I come back, you better be on the lawn. That's it. All right, so three parts of my bottom. So diabetic, I think I'm going to go blind. Maybe I ought to stop drinking. And I got the medication for it. It says, hey, take this the rest of your life. And by the way, no martinis. You know that no martini sign? I was like, oh, how am I going to do this? So at that end, thus I entered my binge drinking phase, where I would not drink for 10 days, and everybody was deliriously happy during that phase, and then get hammered for 4 days straight, and then clean up and go back to work. And that lasted for a while. And then I met, Mr. Wright. I met Norman. And so when I hit that bottom, I named it Norman. I found myself in love with a guy that I met at Whiskers, where I met all of my, Mr. Wrights. And we had so much in common. We were both lying to our families about being in recovery. We both didn't mind dancing when there was no band. We're both the same age. He asked me out to go to his sister's wedding. He thought, long story short, I got the date for a wedding with him. It's going to be great. But in the meanwhile, I hook up with an old friend. We got tickets for Page and Plant. And got a limo and some outside issues to snort and what the hell. So I go to that concert. You know, I can't remember my last drunk to get sober because it was pretty good fun where I can remember. But the next morning, I was so hungover, and there was a stranger in my house, and I was drinking a warm Budweiser, and he was very grossed out by that. And it's all I had, just like my mom. She would have warm Budweiser under the bed. Yeah. Better than just big chunks of meat.
Yeah.
It's my friend Maren. There I was, and I was just astonished and ashamed, and I was at that place of demoralization again, and I had cheated on Norman, and I thought, I've got to stop drinking. I mean, this was the relationship of a lifetime. Finally, the man that really loves me, and I've got to stop drinking to save the relationship. And it was a Saturday morning, and I had come to AA before with a friend of mine. She got a DUI and needed a sobriety buddy and all that crap, and so we tried it for a few days, but you know, that didn't work for me, and I went back out. I didn't work any steps, didn't get a sponsor. I went to the meetings in the dark and disqualified because I still had a big job, nice car, all my teeth, you know. So I'm like, no, I am not an alcoholic. So I went back out. And so anyway, so then I'm in this place where I've just got to save this relationship. And so I told my friend Patty, who I just saw recently, too, and we talked about it. I said, Patty, I feel so just awful. I cheated on Norman. She goes, Norman? I said, yeah, Norman. You know Norman. She goes, red-haired Norman? Yeah. She goes, you're in a relationship with him? And I said, yeah. She goes, he's gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But that had never been my type. Never. And I did not believe her. She said, Meredith, he's not at Emory. He's not studying science. He works at Riches in the linens department. So I went to Riches with my sister. And there he was, holy linens. But I got sober from that point. So my God has a sense of humor. Because I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to save a relationship that does not exist. How about that? And that's the truth. I don't have to lie, do I? Told you I didn't have to lie. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my cousin had sent me a pamphlet about a couple years before saying, I love you, you're my cousin, we drank together, and I'm sober 1 year in AA, got to try it. I'm like, and she goes, and you'll find instant simpatico. And I'm like, who the hell was that? You know, I did not want to come here and be a member of a club that would have me as a member, frankly. But anyway, so I started showing up and sitting on my hands and wishing and hoping. Now, I believed in God as a kid. My mother told me so, and it was true. And I watched her heart get stomped on. And as life happened, my dad leaves, my dad dies, my mom becomes alcoholic. I go to a women's college, come out crazy. I come out crazy, that's what I call myself. You know, and then all this bad stuff keeps happening. I wonder if there's a God. Why does this bad stuff happen? You know, and so I became less sure of God. Now, we agnostics, the word agnostic means that the existence or non-existence of God cannot be proven or known. And I believed that at that point, just like Bill Wilson did. I need proof of a God. Because you're telling me I'm powerless over alcohol and I need a higher power, but how do I find him? And then I read this and it's like, so I get this sponsor. I'll get there. So I get this sponsor. I found I'm sitting on my hands for a while, and a lot of what I'm hearing is wah, 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 you know, and some stuff that it's like, we'll love you till you can love yourself. I'm like, you people are creepy. You know, I wouldn't do that. So I finally asked, this woman would share, and she was like a beam, you know, it hit right between the eyes. And she said, I wasn't drinking for 6 months. Thought I wanted to kill somebody, went to a meeting instead. I've been listening to this woman for a long time. She introduced me to the book, told me to diagnose myself, and I've been listening to her. She's 10 years younger than I am, and I still listen to her, and I have a method to solve my problems today. And I actually believed what she was saying. She was believable. She was also terrifying. So I was afraid to ask her to be my sponsor. I saw her 3 times and didn't dare ask her. And finally, one day, I got up the nerve, and I went up back to the meeting, and oh, it was her 5th anniversary. I'll never forget. So I'm all ready to ask her, and then it's her 5th anniversary. I'm like, oh, no, now it's going to be cake, and she won't want to be bothered. And but I went up anyway, and I said, will you be my temporary sponsor? And she says, do you want temporary sobriety? I'm like, oh, great. First question wrong. I said, well, no. And she goes, well, it says right here. And she pulls out the big book, of course, and says in the end of the forward to the second edition, it says, vital to permanent recovery is strenuous work when alcoholic with another. And I didn't know you could use the word permanent in here. I like that. You know, I don't want to be recovering 25 years later. Imagine having the flu for 25 years. So she goes, no, be recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And then she said, did you? I said, well, you know, I had some time. I had about 90 days, and I chose to drink again. She goes, you chose to drink again? Did you work the steps? No. Did you have a sponsor? No. Spiritual awakening? No. Then what makes you think you chose? And I thought, I'd like to change my answer. Because I remember when I, that night, that frightening day when I picked up a drink again, that 90-ish days was all I could take, doing it on my own. I was crying as I drove into that bar on a Sunday night, thinking no one with any amount of class or self-respect would be in this bar on a Sunday night. And I couldn't not go in. There was no choice in it whatsoever. I was drinking beyond my will, and I finally understood that. So she said, well, here's what I want you to do. She goes, let's figure out a time you can call me every day. Now, think about it, because it's going to be the last decision you make for a while. And I want you to start reading this book. And you need to diagnose yourself, because you know nothing about the getting sober game, or you wouldn't ask me for help. I'm thinking, damn right. And then she told me to start reading from the beginning and highlight what I could, what I identified with. And then we read once a week, and I identified more. And then I get to the end of the agnostic. She'd say, start over. I'm like, okay. And I'd start over, and I'd read it again. And she goes, you have to smash the delusion that you are like other people. And I don't know how many times I cycled through the first 57 pages, but when I have a sponsee say, I'm starting over again, I'm like, congratulations. You know, because I'm only asking to do what I did. So I finally, you know, she decides that, you know, it says that how it works. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. She told me to come to her house, bring enough food to last all day. As she said, I know you're diabetic and I don't want you passing out on me. She was very loving. She really was. But the way she said it, maybe not so much. So anyway, so she had me write my inventory while she was there. Now, she was napping and I was crying. And I didn't think it was really fair that she should be napping while I was crying. But I'd never done anything like that. You know, and when I was reading, you know, I got a lot of pre-reading ahead. You know, every time I got to toward the end of Reagnostics in my own reading, I liked where we got on page 55 where it says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. And I know that's true because I'm dying to believe it. And the God of my childhood was so hard to wrap my mind around, I thought it must be true. It was like 3-in-1. How can God be 3-in-1? That must be God, because I can't be 3-in-1. Except that I was splitting in half at some point in my dream. That's something else. So it says, we finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. Very straightforward, very factual. And it says, he was much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. It is, in the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. I never looked for God within. I looked for God in the Adirondack Mountains and by the rivers and in the stars and in the back of George Huddy's Barracuda. But where I found God was by doing this analysis. Doesn't sound very spiritual. Make a list of stuff, people I hate, bad stuff I did, harms, you know, and then talk about that. I mean, it's very simple at the end of the day, but what I love about it is the promise of this. It says, if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, you know, opinions formed without facts, basically. Enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself. Then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. Attitude is an angle of approach. Okay? So with this angle of approach, I cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. And what that means in English is God becomes a fact. And God must be a fact for me to continue living on life's terms. Because if I'm unsure of God, then my life makes no sense. That whole idea that Bill talks about 3 times, that if God doesn't exist, then life originates nowhere, rushes nowhere, and means nothing. And I said, well, that's why I'm already there. Right? So what's the harm in trying to find something else? And my sponsor was so, my sponsor was so, so sure of herself. And she would say things like, do what I did, you'll get what I got. I'm like, okay. Yeah. I mean, when I took tests in school, they gave me the information. I said, okay, I passed the test. Right? And, you know, how it works is rarely have we seen a person fail. There are people out there who would say, never, if we do this as thoroughly as we can. And it's been my experience that this works, but the key is to continue. You know, so I do the step five, and I didn't feel like I was walking hand in hand with the universe and all that stuff like Bill did, but I felt so much better on the inside, in the place where I never felt good before. I was so relieved at the end of that day. I was also like, blah, 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 blah. I wasn't sure what all I just did. But as I did my fifth step, my sponsor made my eight step list. Next morning, she says, how are you feeling? I said, I feel pretty good. I put on a flowered shirt. I don't wear flowered shirts. It was a hand-me-down from my mother. But I just wanted to put on a flowered shirt. That's how good I felt. It was a little creepy. But she said, if you want to hang on to that, start doing a nightly review of your day. Keep that channel clear. You have cleared the channel. You've tapped into that God within, the place I never looked. You know, the article on spiritual experience in the back of the book is tremendous. He keeps talking about change and change and change, and I couldn't change to save my life. I couldn't change. And it says here, after practicing this for a few months, it says what takes place in a few short months, and that was my timeline, a few short months, we begin to have a spiritual experience, and we have tapped into an unsuspected inner resource, which we identify as God. So now, I've awakened the God within. It's calling to the bigger God, and as long as I seek, you know, chapter two, step two is all about he comes to those who seek. It doesn't say he comes to those who earnestly believe. It says like four times, seek, seek, seek. This is how I sought. Through the inventory, through the fifth step. Tell it to somebody else makes it real. It also makes it go away. And then it makes it easier for me to identify these things that keep coming up. So step six is a landing place from five. It says, we're ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I was ready. When my sponsor said, after I did my inventory, she goes, there's your will in your life. How do you like it? I was like, I don't like it. I was so ready to be done. So anytime I take the time to look at my defects, and I'm willing to object, right, Liana? If I object, it says, will God take these things we find objectionable? I didn't object to my sarcasm until I was 10 years sober. I thought sarcasm was funny. Until somebody was sarcastic with me, I thought, that's not very funny. And then my mother, at her memorial, everybody talked about two things about her. Her unbelievable kindness and her wit. And I put two and two together. I thought, my mother had never used sarcasm a day in her life. And only then was I willing to look at my sarcasm and decide maybe that's not so kind. And I've done this whole series, 10 CDs on how to fulfill your dream and find your... 2008, lost the job, lost the house, lost the Porsche. It was not fun. But it was important for me to find more compassion and to learn what's important in life. And through that, seeking what's next for me, I listened to 10 CDs about fulfilling your dream and self-analysis and all this. And then the last CD was, how kind are you? I'm like, what's that got to do with anything? But there it was. How kind are you? You know, I've learned that through these steps that the only antidote for resentment is forgiveness. And the only way to really forgive is to do something nice. Pretend they didn't hurt your feelings. Pretend they didn't offend you. Pretend they didn't do that mean thing. And just be nice. That's hard. But that's the fastest way I get over it. You know, and I learned that from a couple of things. You know, I was making zucchini bread for everybody on the planet one year, and I'd recently had my heart broken, and I said, I'll show him. I'm not making him any zucchini bread. That's going to show him. And then the thought came, make the zucchini bread and put her name on it too. And that's what I did. And we're good friends today. When I developed a relationship with a man in Alcoholics Anonymous who had about 15 minutes sober. I had 13 years. Not ideal. Watched him lose his house, one stick of furniture at a time. Watched him lose his job. Watched him lose contact with his son. Offered him a room in my house. and thus begin the journey of getting to know somebody on a whole different way, wanting more for what they want than what I want. And we were very different. And I remember we communicated differently. He'd shut down or say something very cold and calculating and incisive. And I'd be like, oh, I'll talk to you. And so we had to find a way to, you know, communicate. But we had a few rules in the house. One was, you do your laundry, you wash it, you dry it, you get it out. You wash it, you dry it, you get it out. It's one of these days when I was kind of mad at him for not listening to me. I go to the laundry room, and there it is. His laundry is in the dryer. Oh. So I pull it out, and I start folding it. And before I was done with the third shirt, I loved him and forgave him all over again. Fast forward to when he got a job in Phoenix, and it was going to separate us for an unknown period of time, which turned out to be forever, because he died. But when I helped him move so he could be closer to his son, he went off to get the cable connected, and he said, if you would put my shirts away. I'm like, I don't know how you do your shirts. But I started folding his shirts and putting them on the shelf, and it brought back the folding of the laundry, and I was just sobbing when he came in the door. And he said, what is it? I said, I don't know when I'm going to get a chance to fold your laundry again. But we put it in God's hands, and we just we'll see what happened. I took off for a job in Minneapolis. He took off for a job in Phoenix. I saw him one time. He got to connect with his son again, which was miraculous. He got to teach him how to pray, and they hung out together, and they did everything together, so much so that he never returned my calls. He said, you don't understand what it's like to have a 7-year-old with you. You just don't, no time. And because that 7-year-old and I became friends when his father died when he was 8, I know exactly what he means. Because I spend twice a year with that boy who's now 20 years old and in the Army. And we have done mountain biking and hiking and skiing and zip lining, and I'm his person. You know, people say, is that your grandmother? No, she's my friend. He asked me to be his godmother. Nightmare is Gunner's godmother. And I've never had any children, but he does it for me. You know, he gives me someone to love. You know, all those years ago when I was needy, if only someone would love me. That's not it. If only I can love somebody else. And see, you teach me here. I also don't really get a choice. You know, God tells me to help the ones that ask for the help. And I have to help the unlovable too, because I was one like that. I don't know what step I'm on. Does anybody listen? Can anybody tell me where I am? Okay, the 6, 7 objectives. 8. Okay, so I did my amends, and I remember how I can do that on an ongoing basis. I mean, the first pass just gets a big chunk of truth out. You know, about a year into my sobriety, I knew a guy that had gotten sober and was diagnosed with cancer. He was going to die. And he said, I'm so glad I got to do my amends because I'm good to go. And the minute he said it, I thought, Luann. I owe Luann an amends. And she was one of my best friends from school. I learned that I envy all of my friends. All my best friends, I have an envy issue. They have something I want. Luann was confident. Always could just, anyway. So I thought, I told my sponsor, I said, I think I owe my friend Luann an amends. I kind of told her off through her parents. She wasn't even there. Luann says hello. Luann, I was like Beetlejuice. To her parents. But God, we just wanted to say hi. So I said, I'm going to call her. And so I called her up and I said, Luann, I owe you an amends. I said, I'm working my 9-step in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, Lordy, Lordy, Meredith McCain, my husband's got 9 years. I know all about the amends. Just like that. We were friends again. So I can continue to do this if I'm willing to do my written inventory. You know, 10 is continue to take personal inventory. If I'm wrong, promptly admit it. There's also spot check inventory. And so my sponsor told me, do the written one until you notice the stuff during the day. You know, you plow through the day. I'm not mad. I'm not afraid. None of the other night, I'm like, So I got to connect the two. You know, I'm supposed to stop when agitated, pause, you know, so my behavior changes. And over time that happened. And I'm much more aware, this constant companionship with God. Step 11, you know, my sponsor told me, do you pray? And I said, yeah. She goes, do you pray on your knees? And I said, no, I feel kind of awkward when I pray on my knees. And she said, well, why don't you try it? And I thought, well, yeah, because I prayed on my knees as a kid, and I used to take my shirt off in the bar, and that was awkward, so why not pray on my knees? So I prayed on my knees. And sometimes when it's really bad, I'm on my face. I've lost a lot in sobriety. I've had a lot of grief. Grief and I are constant companions. After losing my mom and my boyfriend 2 weeks apart, I lost my job, lost my two cats, and then things went well for a time, and then COVID hit, and my oldest brother died of despair, literally. He was in a rehab unit. He didn't want to live anymore. He stopped eating. By the time we knew what was going on, he was 118 pounds. He left an 8-year-old daughter, a 12-year-old daughter, and a 17-year-old daughter. We brought him back to Georgia, my sister. We're going to bust him out of that rehab and bring him back to Georgia. And we did. And I wish I could have had a picture of him lying, looking like a skeleton in the back of that Volvo station when I go with a Yankee baseball cap, going back to Georgia. And we had him with us for the last week, and I got to sit by his side. My friend Riley was there with us. My hand was on his pulse when it stopped. And we got to play beautiful music and just talk. But he suffered from the spiritual malady and never did a searching and fearless moral inventory. He never could admit to another human being. He always thought that God could solve it. And as much as he was swinging for my soul, all the years he was alive, in that last 2 weeks of his dying, he didn't know where God was, and it was terrible to watch. And I know that I could be there if I don't stay connected. And by taking the people through the steps, I stay connected. By staying in this program, I stay connected. I can't afford not to be connected. I know what it does to people in my family. And then my that was my oldest brother. And my brother younger than me, who were about a year apart, he was like my other wingman. And he and I were probably the closest of all. And he was a tough guy. I mean, tough spirited, meaning he felt a little sick, you know, at the end of 2019 and just wasn't going to go to the hospital. And he had moved a mile away from his ex-wife and kids so he could be nearby, so he could snow blow the driveway and rake the leaves. But when he was sick, she wouldn't let them go over there and see him. And a lot of people want to blame her and his children for his death. But I know that he was kind of a stubborn guy. And I'm okay to the point that he didn't die on the kitchen floor. That would have been bad. But he died in his sleep. But I want to be able to love his children because I love him. And they are very odd. They're like their mother who's reclusive. They are narcissistic. They don't have a generous bone in their bodies. And I'm going to go spend Thanksgiving with them. Because she needs help with cleaning out the house, and they want to do a Thanksgiving dinner. She can't do it. She doesn't know where to start. She suffers from a spiritual malady, though she doesn't know it. So I'm going to spend a few days with my older brother's three kids and do a sleepover, and then I'm going to drive and do Thanksgiving with my other brother's kids, because I love them, and I want to not dislike their children. And the only way to do it is to love. Nothing overcomes hate more than love. Nothing. And that's what I learned by doing this thing. I didn't, you know, you love me till I love myself. My sponsor told me, I'll love you until you can love somebody else. She said, because it's been about you all your life. And in the giving, I don't always do it because I like it. Oh my gosh. You know, when my boyfriend Aaron Rodgers hears that I miss a game. No, I'm kidding. My boyfriend's Johnny Depp. I'm not at all delusional. No, but what I have to give up something. To sacrifice means giving up something. And that's the highest form of love there is. And it's not conditional. I can't say I'm only going to love you if you don't do this or if you don't do that. I don't have those choices. You know, I'm going to love because it makes me feel better when I love than when I hate. And I don't like being afraid either. I do it afraid. You know, the book talks about men of faith have courage. We hear sometimes in the meetings, if you have fear, you don't have faith. But that's not what the book says. The book says men of faith have courage. And courage is a quality of mind to face fear or danger. So that means men of faith face fear and danger. Did I leave any steps out? Well, meditation was a little short on meditation. But the thing is, it changes. You know, it has evolved. Sometimes it's really deep, you know, a big dive with written things in the morning and what's on my mind. And sometimes it's a quick thing because I woke up late and I got to get on the computer. And in those cases, I say, Alexa, play the Lord's Prayer by Andrea Bocelli. And it's like the angels. He sings it with the background of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and it's like, sometimes I say, play Johnny Depp's album 18. That's a little more obscene, but that has its time, too. Anyway, so that has changed over time, my prayer meditation. But here's the thing. I don't ever feel like I'm not with God anymore. It's kind of, you know, those worldly clamors do not interfere anymore. And if they do, I'm sure to talk about it with somebody. I'll run it by somebody, you know, and they'll kind of get my mind straight. But it really, it's fleeting. My relationship with God is good. I don't always feel God, but I know God is there, and that's what's important for me to stay sober. And I am enjoying the fruits of that relationship. I cannot worry as much, and I cannot be as judgmental. I can try to see people from, you know, the more I understand me, the more I understand you. And then, you know, like when I'm afraid, I gossip. When you're afraid, you might show off. Tell us a little bit. So the more I understand me, the more I understand you, and then we're all good. I usually close with something out of the book, but this, I went to a cluster forum. I'm, you know, 24 years sober. I figure I can handle a cluster forum. So I went to one on Saturday, and this guy shared this with me, and it says, symptoms of inner peace, a tendency to think and act spontaneously rather than on fears based on past experience, an unmistakable ability to enjoy each moment, a loss of interest in judging other people, a loss of interest in conflict, a loss of the ability to worry, frequent, overwhelming episodes of appreciation. Episodes. Contented feelings of connectedness with other, nature, self, and God. Frequent attacks of smiling. An increasing tendency to let things happen rather than make them happen. An increased susceptibility to the love extended by others, as well as the uncontrollable urge to extend it. Thank you very much for having me tonight.
Wow. How do you follow that?
I have no words.
There was laughter. There was tears. There was hope. There was... Thank you so much. We have asked Lisa to come up and give chips.
Hey, I'm Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa.
Meredith Rock. That was so fucking awesome. I made a good choice. Here at the Blue Chip Speakers meeting, we give out chips to show how long you've been away from alcohol. Does anybody want to pick up a white chip tonight? Okay. 30 days.
All right. Woo!
Woo! 60 days. 90 days.
All right.
6 months.
All right.
9 months. Anybody have a year sober other than my special friend here? Okay, I'm going to give this chip to Ellen. I love Ellen. She's my friend. I'm getting to know her very well. She's stepping up and doing some service work. I really appreciate the challenges and how you're meeting them. Here's your...
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. So this is 3 years.
Yes.
And I was thinking the other day, I was just kind of off in my little world, and someone said to me, you know, Ellen, what do you think about? And I said... I was just thinking about 3 years ago. First of all, I was thinking about how grateful I was that I woke up sober that morning. Because 3 years before that, I was begging God to not let me wake up. Begging God. I couldn't even walk. I was crawling on the floor to let the ambulance in to get me off of the second floor because I was having seizures. And it was bad. Stay connected. I know that God put me here for a reason. I know that He allowed me to go through that relapse, that bad relapse, because I never fully conceded to the fact that I was an alcoholic and I could never put a drink back in my body again. He had to let me go through that. So I know now, if I want to go, I'll take a drink, and I just, that's not where I want to be. I appreciate all y'all for being here, and your story was phenomenal. So, thank you so much.
Thank you. Anybody else? White chip?
White.
Most important chip, surrender. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Live forever.